It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferris. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Have you ever had an experience where you felt like you just didn't fit in? You couldn't figure out the right things to say? You felt like you didn't connect with people? You had trouble making friends or relating to coworkers? Maybe your background or childhood didn't provide you with the cultural references or social rules that everyone else seemed to just know. Our next guest grew up trying to come to terms with what she calls her weirdness. Olga Kazan is a staff writer for The Atlantic, where she covers health and science. I talked to her earlier this year about her book, Weird, The Power of Being an Outsider in an Insider World. Olga, welcome back.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me on.
Can you talk a little bit about your personal experience? That was a big part of the inspiration for you wanting to pursue this concept of weirdness.
Yeah, I got really interested in what it was like to feel different and kind of the state of difference because of my childhood. I'm a Russian Jewish refugee, and I grew up in Midland, Texas, which is in far west Texas. I was really, for a long time, the only kid like me that that was around. Sort of even beyond that kind of initial phase of feeling like an oddball, like in my classes and things like that. It was just sort of a early childhood experience that really stuck with me and kind of permeated a lot of my psychology later on in life. And kind of some of the things that held me back, but also kind of carried me forward. So I really wanted to look into what that was all about and what is it like to be a fish out of water and what's the psychology behind that. So that's when I started reaching out to other people who had different, but similar kind of experiences of being unlike everyone else around them, to kind of learn from them and learn what their experiences were like.
And choosing the word weird as your title, I think ends up fitting really well because it's a double or maybe quadruple edged sword. Some people embrace weird as a positive thing. Some people, I think, recoil from it. And you see that whole range of experiences in the people you talk to.
Yeah, totally. I mean, most of the I talk to people who were, for example, like a male preschool teacher or a liberal living in a really conservative environment or a conservative living in a really liberal environment. Weird is often something that people say in a kind of insulting way toward people they don't agree with or who they think are different. But I was kind of trying to reclaim it and say that, it can actually be a good thing to be weird and that we shouldn't shy away from the label quite so much like we do.
There are downsides, and they're big and small depending on people's experiences. One thing that really struck me, it was a group of, I think, faculty members at a school said, hey, for the next week, we're going to take turns. One of us is going to be ostracized. We're going to pick that one person. They're going to have, I think they actually had a scarlet O, right? And we're going to be mean to them and ignore them and dismiss them. And even though everybody knew it was just kind of an exercise, it felt really terrible. What did you hear from that that intentional experience of weirdness?
Yeah, so this is just a really, I thought, poignant example of how awful ostracism can feel, even in adulthood, and even, in fact, when you're in on what's happening. We often think that, after, middle school or high school, people, feeling like an oddball isn't really like a big deal. But in fact, these researchers found, they would kind of label each one of their offices as with an O for ostracized for that day. And then they would know they were going to be ignored that day, but they were ignored by their colleagues that day. And they felt like it was really hurtful. They wrote things in their journals like, I feel like a ghost on the floor that no one sees. And, they started doing like anything they could imagine just to get their colleagues to acknowledge them. Like it really struck them that they were being kind of snubbed and ostracized in that way, even though, they knew why it was happening and they knew that it was going to come to an end soon. So that just goes to show how hurtful this kind of experience can be, especially when we're like not invited to a wedding or, a baby shower or something like that. That can actually be a lot more deep and hurtful than, it might seem on its face.
We're talking to Olga Kazan. Her new book is called Weird, The Power of Being an Outsider in an Insider World. We'll maybe talk more about the downside of being weird and meet some of the people that, you met in the course of researching this, Olga. But I want to look at some of the upside, too. And you found, as you looked into the research on this, having, say, outsiders, the weird people in a group, on a committee, whatever, could actually lead to better outcomes, better decision making. What is behind that?
Totally. So this has been a consistent finding in psychology that having someone who is kind of a competing perspective or a minority view on a team can actually help the team make better decisions. They help you avoid the sunk cost fallacy, which is this idea that like we should follow through with this bad idea to the end just because we've already started doing it. You know, people are less likely to kind of follow along with groupthink and with obviously bad decisions if there's just one person who's willing to say, "Hey, wait a second, I don't know about this." You know, that person does risk looking like a outsider or like someone who's unusual, but they actually help the whole team kind of triumph in the end. One quote from the researchers, some of the research that I read was, defiance per se, the explicit flaunting of a majority's claim for truth significantly reduces the grip of conformity on observers, which I thought was a really powerful, defiance per se, testament to the power of weirdos.
And another benefit may come in the form of creativity. How does that work?
Yeah, so this has also been kind of been held up in studies, which is this idea that people who have traveled abroad or in a culture that is not like their own or have even just been rejected socially tend to come up with more creative solutions to problems. And the way they tested this is actually having volunteers come into a lab and then rejecting half of them. So kind of saying like, you guys are not going to work with the group on this one. So they kind of felt like, oh, what did we do? We're kind of like outsiders here. And then they would have everyone draw these aliens. They were supposed to be from a planet very unlike our own. And it turned out that the people who were rejected actually drew more creative looking aliens than the people who were included, because they sort of felt like, you know, I am already not part of this group. I already don't have to impress them. You know, I don't need to follow any rules. I can just kind of throw spaghetti at the wall and come up with whatever. So it kind of just shows you how, even though it might not be necessarily fun to be kind of the odd one out, it can definitely let those brain juices flow and help you come up with creative ideas.
That's drawing Martians in this lab experiment. Do you see that playing out kind of in the real world? You and or the many people you talk to who were in one way or another outsiders harnessing that that for creativity?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's been like definitely smaller level things where I have, come up with creative ideas, and you know, I can never be sure if it's because I had this weird background or because just of something else. There are a few interesting examples from history, Nabokov wrote Lolita when he was traveling, and Picasso started experimenting with cubism when he was living abroad, not in his native culture. So there is kind of this benefit to kind of being a fish out of water that can help you kind of come up with new ideas. And that's definitely something I saw in the people that I interviewed too.
We're revisiting a conversation with Olga Kazan about her book, Weird, The Power of Being an Outsider in an Insider World. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our conversation with Olga Kazan. We're talking about her new book, Weird, The Power of Being an Outsider in an Insider World. Olga, I want to talk some about strategies that different people have adopted in this situation of being an outsider, being seen as weird. And one is kind of a power through strategy. And I hope you could share the story of this doctor. He's now at Johns Hopkins University. And he was looked at when he was applying to medical schools as not a likely prospect. Can you tell that story?
Yeah, I was just so inspired by this guy's persistence and perseverance. This is Michael Aine. He's a surgeon, and he has short stature. He has dwarfism. So when he was applying to medical school, it was still kind of an era where there was this expectation that doctors would look a certain way and act a certain way. Really the fact that he was short was holding him back. People were outright saying, you know, patients won't respect you, you know, they want tall, imposing doctors. And so he was rejected from something like 30 medical schools. And he just kept going. He honestly, you know, he applied to the 31st after he was, you know, rejected from 30. And the same thing happened when he started applying to surgery programs too. And I was just so kind of inspired by him, because I don't know that many people who would, you know, not be discouraged by that or take it as a sign that they weren't going to make it, and instead just be even more motivated to break through. And so I kind of started the book with him, because I just remembered talking to him and was like blown away by his spirit. And he actually ended up making it to Johns Hopkins, which is of course one of the best hospitals in the country, and became like a renowned surgeon who actually helps kids of short stature and helps them with their spinal and kind of bone issues. So he kind of came full circle and ended up helping other people like him.
Another strategy you talk about is, you know, finding similar people when that's possible, finding people in your situation. What kind of stories did you encounter along those lines?
Yeah. So, you know, I really just found that even though, you know, by their nature, these folks are living or working in situations where there's not going to be a lot of other people doing their same thing. But what they do is they kind of build communities of supporters around them. So in the case of Julia Landauer, this really great NASCAR driver that I followed for a while, she really has a really supportive family. Not necessarily like financially, you know, she still has to hustle and get out there and raise money for her own racing, but her family is just very morally supportive. They come to a lot of her races. They help her with coaching and like kind of give her tips and strategies and feedback on how she's doing. So I felt like she really had this like crew of people who were like rallying around her and like helping her out. And so she kind of, I feel like that kind of helped her weather this really tough profession, not just for the racing, but just like the financials of NASCAR are really hard to make work apparently. I was really impressed by her ability to do that. And then, you know, the other thing I noticed is just like people who would find friends who are really supportive of their decisions. I interviewed this one, they're called, Choice Moms. It's like women who, have a baby on their own without getting married first. So they'll just have a sperm donor and have a baby that way. That's like a decision that is often like frowned upon in some cultures. But this woman who had a really great experience doing that actually, you know, had her friends over and they all picked the sperm donor together. And it was like this big party and they all celebrated it. And, you know, like her whole like community was like, yay, you. And that definitely makes it easier to make those kinds of decisions when you have that kind of community.
Let's bring on our callers now. Julia is with us in Heartland. Julia, hi.
Hi, hello.
Hi, what do you want to tell us about Julia?
So just as part of, I guess, my destined path that I just decided very early on in high school was that I was going to get into metal fabrication and welding, which is definitely not something that is meant for, you know, women. And it's definitely a weird path that people just decide very early on. And I definitely got some flack for it in the beginning of my path on going into being a fabricator. I definitely got some men who were definitely trying to show me up. But it was definitely one of the best decisions I've made, even though it wasn't a traditional path for somebody like myself. And I've definitely been able to make these incredible things and teach other people and just get them also inspired to join like the fabrication and manufacturing field. And it's definitely something that was so worth going into something that was just untraditional.
And Julia, let me ask you, was there something you think that helped you get through those earlier stages when you were facing that, you know, the rejection, the men, as you said, trying to show you up, and that got you to where you are now?
I think just the challenge of it and just being told, like, you're not really going to make it, like, you can't really lift steel, you can't really weld as good as I can, and just that challenge of, yeah, you think this, but let me show you that you're wrong, was really what kind of pushed me to just be better than where I started.
Thanks a lot for sharing that with us, Julia. Olga, what do you think?
Yeah, she reminds me a lot of this woman, Michelle, who I interviewed, who became one of the only African-American female law partners. There's very few of those, and then actually then became head of the NBA Players Association. But she, her whole life was told, you know, you're never going to make it, you're not good enough, because she was this very high achieving African American woman from a poor neighborhood, and she was just completely driven to show up her haters and to show how awesome she was and to like blow everyone out of the water and to, have everyone's jaw drop after she kind of shows them up. So that can definitely be a huge motivator, is this desire to be better than the people who doubt you.
Thanks a lot for sharing that, Julia. We'll go to Lenny now in McFarland. Lenny, hello.
Hello. I grew up in Brooklyn, New York, and went to a really good, one of the 10 best high schools in the country at that time. And then I went for my sophomore year to Purdue, where I had terrible culture shock. And the girls I was with initially thought I was weird, and I thought they were dumb. And I enjoyed when they needed me to tutor them. Making remarks, I have reduced this concept to its irreducible minimum. I don't see what you can't see.
Letty, thanks for calling in. Are there ways you can see, Olga, that we can, reach across that mutual sense of weirdness when we're in a new place?
Yeah. I definitely think that so this is something that one of the psychologists that I interviewed mentioned, is that if you go into a situation anticipating that people will like you and that they'll have a good reaction to you, that can actually help kind of generally improve the nature of the interaction. Like it's a little bit of a subconscious, like people can kind of tell when you look like you think that they're not going to like you. So, you know, if you just go in kind of expecting the best and expecting things to go well, then they generally will. So I think that might be one strategy, is just to realize, hey, you know, I'm a little unusual here. I'm not from around here, but, you know, we are going to find something that we have in common, and I'm going to, you know, have a fine time here. Could be just a good mindset to try to rehearse, even though it's can be difficult at times, I realize.
Do you have thoughts for the non-weird part, the insiders, to, you know, check themselves and think about how they react to the outsider in their midst?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think like, and it's been a good thing, you know, society has gotten more open-minded, I think, in the past few years. And like, even one of the people that I interviewed, she was this sociology professor who was fairly liberal, living in the most conservative congressional district in the country. And she found that it became kind of easier to interact with, and you know, students knew more about some of the subject matter she was teaching, just because society's become more open and accepting. So students would know about things like the glass ceiling, or they'd be familiar with the concept of feminism, or, you know, they'd be familiar with the concept of gender identity going into the semester. You know, that wasn't necessarily something she had to like introduce for the first time, whereas, you know, maybe 10 or 20 years ago it would have been. So I think in general, society's becoming more open, which is definitely making it easier on all the weirdos out there.
We'll go back to your calls. Rana is with us in Cameron. Rana, hello.
Hello, Rob. After I graduated from college, I with a degree in meat animal science, I wasn't able to find a woman at that time But anyway, I was hired by Farm and Fleet, and I became one of the, I was the first woman in their management training program. And that was a bit of a strange experience because there was no one around that looked like me. After I worked there, I went into back to school and got my teaching degree in ag education. And again, this a similar experience. I was one of the only females back in the day teaching ag education and also shop classes such as welding and construction. And so anyway, I always kind of felt like an outsider, kind of a weirdo, I guess. There's always going to be people that want to work with you because they want to be successful. And if you want to be successful, that'll show in your actions and your comments and your leadership that you bring to wherever you are. And so then you work with the people that want to be there, that want to work with you, and the others, they're just missing out on a great opportunity.
All right, Rana, thank you so much. And Olga, that reminds me of a category in your book, and a couple of our callers and people you've mentioned fit this category, the trailblazers, the people who are willing to be that first odd one out, and maybe other people follow suit later.
Yes, and the cutest example of this was the first people to try online dating. Of course, now we think that it's so common and that anyone would do it, and we're all meeting on OkCupid or Tinder or whatever it is. But when it first started, this was considered like something you would only do if no one, you know, you couldn't find anyone any other way. And so these people were getting on Match.com in, you know, the late 90s and sending each other emails, and like they couldn't actually send each other photos of themselves because internet connections were not strong enough to upload a photo at the time. So they were sending each other photos like through the post, like through the mail. And, you know, all their relatives thought, you know, that they were going to get axe murdered the second they met up. But they're both still married and they're very happy. And I think that kind of feeling of being kind of an innovator and a trailblazer and willing to do something a little unusual is actually like something that kind of attracts them to one another. Like it seems like they kind of like that about each other, that they were willing to kind of go out on a limb.
Wasn't it they were both willing to meet somebody within a 500-mile range, and they did the math and they lived 499 miles apart?
Yes, I thought that was the craziest. That just so happened. Like they didn't even realize that they lived that far away from each other at the time. So yeah, it was lucky for them.
We're re-listening to a conversation with Olga Kazan about her book, Weird, The Power of Being an Outsider in an Insider World. She's a staff writer for The Atlantic, where she covers health and science. We'll listen back to the rest of our chat after the news. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the president and vice president are in Wisconsin this week in person. We'll look at what these kinds of appearances mean at this stage in the pandemic and the presidential race. Now we're listening back to our conversation with Olga Kazan. She's a staff writer for The Atlantic, where she covers health and science. We talked to her earlier this year about her book, Weird, The Power of Being an Outsider in an Insider World. I want to visit one story you tell from here in Wisconsin, where a county that a lot of people around the country paid attention to because it was a big swing county in votes, Trumbull County. Can you talk about what you learned when you talked to a Mexican immigrant named Gloria that you interviewed?
Yeah, so I interviewed a few individuals in that county who had immigrated, and I just want to say they all said they had, you know, built a good life there. For the most part, people were very accepting, but it just kind of spoke to some of the tensions that that people feel whenever they're an immigrant or an outsider, because it seemed like when they first got there, they were sort of kept at arm's length, not like fully integrated because they didn't necessarily speak the language or whatever else, you know, but ultimately they were able to be accepted. But then there got to be more and more immigrants in that area. And there was sort of an influx because of some things that changed in the economy and with immigration patterns. And then there was actually a little bit of a backlash to immigration there. And there was kind of this local sentiment that, well, now we have too many immigrants and we need to do something about that. So actually, after voting for Obama twice, that county went for Trump in 2016, in part because, political researchers think there was this sort of backlash to the wave of immigrants. So I talked to some of the immigrants who were part of that wave and how they experienced that.
Yeah. What did you hear about how they felt about living through that change?
Yeah. I mean, they were hesitant to be critical of their neighbors. But one thing that I thought was interesting was that even these really young immigrants who are basically dreamers, they're essentially, they've grown up in America, but they are technically not citizens. They had a really strong affinity for Mexico and really spoke Spanish, enjoyed watching kind of Mexican shows and had dreams of returning to Mexico to live, even though they had grown up in the U.S. And I wonder if some of that isn't reacting to some of this immigrant backlash that they've experienced, this sort of feeling that if you're not fully comfortable with us, we're going to kind of be more closely tied to the place that is more central to our identity. And I actually saw that with my own parents, too. I feel like they're more closely connected with Russian culture, even though they've lived here for more than 30 years now.
You look at some of the sociology when it comes to conformity or acceptance of difference, and there's a real continuum from one society to another or one community to another. And made me think we've got kind of a two-pronged thing going on here in American culture where so many of our pop culture heroes are, the outsiders, the rebels, the bold thinkers who get things done. And yet we've got a pretty heavy conformist streak mixed in there at the same time. Is that weird here in the United States, or I don't know? I guess you'd need a huge international study. But what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah. So the difference you're describing is between tight and loose cultures. So tight cultures are those that have a lot of rules and a lot of they have a lot of conformity. There's like a certain way to do everything, a certain way to dress, a certain way to behave. If you think about religions like the Amish, that's a tight culture. They kind of mandate everything you're going to do your whole life. A loose culture is like Burning Man, right? It's like, do whatever you want. There's no rules. You can dress however. You can, do whatever. So I think different parts of America are different kind of levels of tight and loose. I think a lot of the kind of renegade heroes that we have come up in Silicon Valley, which I think is like a pretty loose culture. It's startups are a very loose culture, and it's just full of startups and technology companies, which just tend to be more freer to those kinds of like creative types. So even if you're like the CEO who screams at everyone and wears the same thing every day and whatever else you're going to do that's like really unusual, that's going to be more accepted in that loose culture because, that there already aren't a lot of rules that you have to follow. So I think that might be part of what you're seeing there.
I want to wrap up looking at the unwritten rules that can make it hard for that outsider to figure out how to fit in. And you write about your own experience with this, I think, in college, not being part of the high school culture in the past. You didn't know, for example, the rule for how to end a conversation. Could you talk about how hard it is for that outsider to suss out the rules that everybody else knows but can't necessarily even explain?
Yeah, I mean, that was like an extreme experience of mine. Like, I just didn't have a lot of, my parents never had anyone over, and I never had really like formal conversations before I went to college. I think day to day, people experience this with office dress codes or office, speech or office. I remember, so I used to work at the Washington Post, and one of my first days, I went to this this meeting, and I sat in like the wrong chair at the
oh,
at
no.
the meeting, and I sat in this chair that was really important for someone like really high up. And you know, it's just like all those little subtle things that you don't realize, but that everyone else realizes, that you know, you don't necessarily pick up on. But you know, there's like so many of these subtle rules, just like RSVPing to a wedding, and what do you wear to a wedding, and you know, what do you do when someone says this or that, or what do you say when your boss asks you to do something? Like there's just a million ways that we kind of codes that we follow in order to make everyone around us more comfortable. And for people who are weird, those codes can be really difficult to learn.
Olga, we'll end the conversation with me thanking you for joining us. It's been a lot of fun.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me on.
That was Olga Kazan, staff writer for The Atlantic, where she covers health and science. We listened back to a conversation with her about her book called Weird, The Power of Being an Outsider in an Insider World. According to the State Department of Health Services, nearly 400,000 people have been tested for COVID-19 here in Wisconsin since mid-March. For many, what it feels like to get a test for the new coronavirus is still a mystery. WPR's Laurel White went to get a COVID-19 test and has this report on what it was like.
I decided to get a COVID-19 test because I've been in crowds of hundreds, sometimes thousands of people, several times over the past couple weeks as I've covered Black Lives Matter protests and events. Sometimes people weren't wearing masks. I was often very close to people who were yelling, which sends more of the droplets that can spread the new coronavirus into the air. I also had to get in the middle of crowds, brushing by lots of people to get pictures or audio I needed for a story. So making sure I didn't get the virus at these events so I can make smart decisions about who I see in the days and weeks to come seemed like a good idea. When I arrived at the free testing site at the Alliant Energy Center in Madison, I was told to drive around the back of the building. I joined a line of about 24 cars. I pulled up to a man in a mask, gloves, and a medical gown and rolled down my window.
Yourself today?
Yep, just me.
Okay, how about lane number 2, please?
Okay.
Thank you.
After a couple minutes, I pulled up to 2 more men, also wearing protective gear. They were holding clipboards.
Hello.
Hi there.
How are you doing?
Good, how are you?
Good. Have you been exposed to a confirmed or suspected case of COVID-19?
No.
Are you experiencing any symptoms today?
No.
Your first and last name and spelling, please.
Laurel, L-A-U-R-E-L. At this point, I was getting kind of nervous. I was a little embarrassed to feel that way, but I had no idea what to expect. Was the test going to hurt? How long was it going to take? I could see where the cars were going, into a building through 2 big garage doors, but I couldn't see testing happening. Luckily, the next man, who had on a camouflage mask and was the last gatekeeper before you drove through the garage doors into the testing site, directly addressed my fears.
There's no sense of being nervous. The least they can do is put you in quarantine.
He told me National Guard soldiers would be doing my test and that I could expect my results in about 5 to 7 days. Then he waved me through the garage door.
There you go. Good luck
to
you. Come on in.
Thank you so much. I pulled up next to a folding table. 3 people in medical gowns, masks, and gloves were there, next to a whiteboard that said, "Think positive, test negative," with a smiley face. The man who I assumed would be doing my test came up to my car. He gave me a tissue and asked me to blow my nose. Then it was time for the main event.
All right, I'm going to go to each nostril for about 4 seconds, okay?
Okay.
Your tick was kind of weird.
He put a long Q-tip looking thing up one of my nostrils. To be honest, there's really no other way to describe it than to say it felt like someone put something a little further up your nose than you'd like. When he did the second nostril, I actually counted in my head. It really was about 4 seconds. Then it was done.
All righty, you're good to go.
Woohoo! Thank you.
Have a good day.
You too. It didn't hurt. It was just uncomfortable. I'd compare it to getting a shot. Just a little twinge. Not something you'd exactly do for fun, but definitely not horrible. The free testing site in Madison will be open for anyone who wants to get tested until June 24th. For Wisconsin Public Radio, I'm Laurel White.
For information about testing sites in your area, you can call your local health department or go to dhs.wisconsin.gov/COVID-19. And since this feature was recorded, the Alliant Energy Center community test site has been extended and is scheduled to be open until at least August 7th. Coming up, we'll talk about Vice President Mike Pence's visit to Pewaukee today and why Wisconsin is likely to get a lot of attention in the next 5 months. That's coming up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, President Trump fired the U.S. attorney who was investigating his personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, and more of his associates. We'll talk with a former attorney in that district about the political pressure at play and what it means for the work that investigators are doing. Now, Vice President Mike Pence paid a visit in person, not online, to our state today. He was at events in Pewaukee and Waukesha. The vice president was joined by Education Secretary Betsy DeVos for a roundtable on charter and private voucher schools. Then he held a rally pushing the faith element of President Trump's 2020 campaign, with appearances by former Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker and Trump advisor Kellyanne Conway. Trump is set to follow Pence coming to the Badger State with a visit to the expanding shipyard in Marinette Thursday and a televised Green Bay town hall with Fox News. What significance do these appearances have for the current crises we're facing in Wisconsin and the nation, not to mention the presidential race? Mordecai Lee is a professor emeritus at UW-Milwaukee and a former state lawmaker. Mordecai, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Rob.
How much of a difference in a presidential campaign does having a candidate or a running mate, as the case may be, in a place in person?
Well, to a certain extent, even though we've got 200 years of democracy and elections, nobody really knows what it takes to win an election. Sometimes it's luck, sometimes it's timing, sometimes it's planning. And, you know, to a certain extent, everybody is throwing things against the wall and hoping that something will stick. You know, after all, politics is not that much different from Vince Lombardi's Green Bay Packers. I think it was Vince Lombardi who said, you know, winning is the only thing. And that's why they're doing everything they can to win Wisconsin.
Now, this is a contrast, this in-person appearance of Vice President and Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden. He's doing virtual events. His statement says Donald Trump has gambled with the health of Wisconsin families to benefit his own political fortune at every turn. He goes on criticizing these in-person appearances in the midst of COVID-19. How does this pandemic and, you know, the inclination to steer clear of getting lots of people together affect campaigning this time around?
Well, again, I guess I'd say who knows, in the sense of today, there might be some people who are following the news, and some of them are thinking, wow, Pence bothered to come to Wisconsin in person and Biden didn't. I like Pence. But 2 weeks from now, a month from now, if there's a second wave, if a lot of people get sick from political events, will that same person think, wow, Pence should not have come, and I really respect Biden for not coming? That's literally what politics is about. It's risk assessment, and you just never know what's coming around the corner in the future.
How much of the in-person event is just to capture that local media? We know from research a lot of people still watch the TV news, and this puts the candidates front and center. It gives a reason to pull out the TV cameras.
You know, Rob, I think that is the very first priority of events nowadays. I mean, in the old days, campaigning in person was sort of the way you did it, and by the way, you might get covered by newspapers. Nowadays, they do these events because they want to get what's called free media. Free media meaning local TV stations cover it and then broadcast stories about the event essentially for free. It's the opposite of paying for a commercial. And so this is almost like the tail wagging the dog. They're doing an event to get the free media. After all, in Pewaukee, maybe 200 people, but for the four Milwaukee TV news stations, maybe 10,000, maybe 20,000.
Now, Pence and DeVos held a roundtable about school choice, and Wisconsin and Milwaukee in particular have a long history as early starters when it came to school choice. How important is the focus on that issue?
Well, to a certain extent, these roundtables are, I guess you'd call them sort of fake events, whether it's Democrats doing it or Republicans doing it. They were there for a very short time. They had a script where they wanted to say that they were in favor of it. The people sitting around the table knew they were supposed to say they were for it, and very short time limits. To a certain extent, it's the opposite of the kind of town hall meetings that Congressman Jim Sensenbrenner used to hold. You know, his town hall meeting, he walked in a room, there were maybe 100 people, everybody got to ask a question, you never knew how long it would take or what they'd ask. These are very sort of blueprinted events, scripted events, and again, I think they're done mostly for the free media coverage.
Let's talk about the where. The vice president was in Waukesha County today. The president is scheduled to be in Marinette. Craig Gilbert with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel wrote about those places being, you know, places where Republicans and the Trump campaign need big turnout from their supporters. How important are those two spots?
Given the way Wisconsin is politically nowadays, you know, we used to, when Tommy Thompson was the governor, he used to say that about one-third of Wisconsinites were Democrats, about one-third were Republicans, and about one-third were swing voters, independent voters, and that he, as governor, wanted to appeal to that one-third. Now, in modern times, ever since the governorship of Scott Walker, I don't think it's one-third. I think it's maybe 5%. So then the question becomes, if you're doing political events, what are you trying to accomplish? Are you trying to reach those 5% and persuade them to vote for you? Or maybe what you're trying to do, exactly as you said, Rob, they're simply trying to promote base mobilization. In other words, to excite the base, the people who already support them, to be sure they vote. And so Waukesha County is really sort of the heartland of Republican votes. And President Trump did very well in the Northeast last time. So it looks like these two events are base mobilization rather than persuasion of undecideds.
We're talking to Mordecai Lee, Emeritus Professor at UW-Milwaukee, looking at two big visits from the president and vice president this week and Wisconsin's role in the presidential election. Now, Democrats were going to have their big show in Milwaukee this year, their big Democratic National Convention, where Joe Biden would be nominated officially. Now, it's not going to be as big and flashy or crowded as it would have been because of COVID-19. Do you think that Democrats, though, are going to be trying to plant their flags here in Wisconsin as much as they can?
Well, certainly the rationale for doing it in Milwaukee was so that Democrats would get a leg up to win Wisconsin this time around instead of losing as they did to President Trump last time by, I think it was like 22,000 votes. So in other words, if they could just eke out a little bit more support, a little more turnout, they could win Wisconsin. And surprisingly, it looks like the person, the candidate who wins Wisconsin is going to be the next president. Literally, we, tiny, measly Wisconsin, we're going to decide who the next president is. I think we're all still sort of a little shocked by that. Now, as for the convention, I think the big rationale for it had been for the economic impact, that there would be hundreds of millions of dollars of consumer spending and that this would be a really big plus for the economy. Now this thing is the incredible shrinking convention. I think it's probably going to be down to a day and a half or something like that. There might even be some delegates who never attend or only attend for one day. But nonetheless, I think that having his acceptance speech in Wisconsin, in person, in the Fiserv Center, will be good for Wisconsin, will be good for sort of putting the spotlight on Wisconsin.
Now, social media is big, we know, in campaigns. President Obama, in his campaigns, had done a lot of targeted online stuff. President Trump, of course, noted for his success along those lines, too. Given the difficulty of in-person campaigning, do you see social media playing, if possibly, even a bigger role in 2020?
Gosh, again, it's so hard to predict, but I like the fact that the focus on social media is largely being driven by the pandemic. In other words, 4 years ago, social media was important. And as you said, 8 years ago, it was very important for President Obama to get reelected. But now that you've got the pandemic and social distancing, the traditional things that campaigns did with volunteers, you go to the campaign headquarters and you stuff envelopes. You go to the campaign headquarters and you're on a phone bank. Or you go ringing doorbells. All that stuff is now verboten based on the pandemic. So then the question becomes, how can you overcome the inability to use volunteers, the inability to have that sort of personal touch? Because the personal touch is the thing that really is like a secret sauce of political persuasion. So, yeah, I guess social media is next best, but gosh, we're so saturated by social media, it's almost hard to believe that it would have much of an impact.
Mordecai, in our last minute or so, I think we got two big polls coming out in Wisconsin, the Marquette Law School poll, and then there's a New York-based one, I can't remember which one, but a reliable poll. What are you watching for with two big pieces of data just down the pike there?
What I suggest we look for is the trend, not the exact numbers. especially because the numbers might be tight and within the margin of error. But let's look at the trend compared to a month ago and 2 months ago. Who's coming up? Who's going down? What are those tiny infinitesimal changes that will make a difference of winning Wisconsin by 22,000 votes?
Very briefly, Mordecai, the big story last time around, there were a lot of voters who didn't like Hillary Clinton and didn't like Donald Trump, and most of them, if I'm reading polls right, broke for Donald Trump. Are you watching for a similar phenomenon this year in our last 30 seconds?
I think we might be seeing a mirror image of that. The question is, how are the people who voted for Trump last time around reacting to his leadership of the country in the last few months in terms of both the economy and the pandemic? Are they going to be turning against him for whatever secret reason they're holding? That might make the difference this time.
Mordecai, thanks as always for joining us today.
Anytime, Rob.
We've been talking to Mordecai Lee. He's a professor emeritus at UW-Milwaukee and a former state legislator. We talked to him today about the vice president visiting Wisconsin today, the president scheduled to visit Wisconsin later this week, and, of course, the Democratic National Convention, whatever form it may take, still based in Milwaukee. You can still share your thoughts on those issues over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Here's a fun thing I did over the weekend. I discovered a new food. To be clear, by new, I mean new to me. And by discovered, I don't mean really discovered at all. People have been eating it here in the Midwest for like tens of thousands of years, probably. The food is service berries, also known as Juneberries. And those of you already in the know are thinking, Rob, you didn't know about the service berries? Yeah, no. I'm not exactly your food foraging expert type. Well, we planted a serviceberry tree in the backyard some years back. What I do know about serviceberry trees is rabbits really like serviceberry tree bark. So I'd written off this tree pretty much, but it made a comeback. Now it has tons of berries, and after a bit of internet research, I've started eating them, and they're good. And they're cool because they're native to the region. So to those of you who already knew about serviceberries, help me out. Apart from just eating them straight up, do you cook or bake with them? If so, what do you make? And if you have some cocktail recipes, let me know. Seems like you could muddle them for an old-fashioned, but I could not find any serviceberry old-fashioned recipes online. Share your serviceberry suggestions. Email us, ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Or you can tweet us at Central Time WPR. It's berry news I can use. This is Central Time.